from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, dining out. Where are the best places to eat and where are the most reasonable places to eat at in this present economy? And how about the economic downturn and its effect on dining in general? We'll talk with a trio of restaurant critics about where to eat and what to look for when you go out to eat and whether those who review restaurants, including people who do regular reviews and aren't restaurant critics, can really ever be impartial. It's an hour on restaurants and dining out and restaurant reviewing, which will include your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. And in this forum hour, we turn our attention to dining out in the Bay Area and how one can eat well and, if possible, even eat thrifty in these difficult times. Joining us in studio is Michael Bauer, who is executive food and wine editor and restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle and who just released recently, as many people who read the Chronicle know, his top 100 restaurants, his annual selections. And good to have you here, Michael. Good morning.
Thank you.
Also with us in studio this morning is Marcia Gagliardi, who is author of e-column The Table Hopper, and she's a freelance food writer. And The Table Hopper is not a blog. It's an e-column or e-mail newsletter. Good morning.
Hi there.
Hi. Misha Halm is also here in studio this morning, local editor of Zagat, Bay Area Restaurant Guide, and welcome to you.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here. Well, there's already lots of buzz about Michael Bauer's top 100. Sometimes I like to compare you to the Frank Rich before he became a columnist, when he was known as the Butcher of Broadway. And I don't mean that in any – I mean that in the highest praise. I mean, you make restaurants, you break restaurants in many ways, the way he did Broadway shows. Let's talk a little bit about how you decide on this. It can be aggravating to try to have to come up with a top 100, I imagine.
Yeah, it gets more difficult each year because the first year was kind of easy because, you know, I just kind of started with everything and put together what I thought was a well-balanced list. But I've been doing it now for 15 years about. And it's, you know, I always have new ones coming in and I do try and balance it as best as I can for location and price and type of cuisine, although – if you look at it, you see that it does skew obviously more expensive because they're more destination restaurants. And also the majority of them are probably California or American or whatever we call what we cook here.
Well, the ones that get 4 stars from you also get at least $4. I mean, we're talking about stars and bucks,
right?
Representing more bucks, more expense. And four,
right,
is right at the top.
Yes.
We find a restaurant that can get 4 stars. It could be like maybe even $3, or isn't such a thing exist?
Usually it doesn't because I think they're cooking on a whole different level, although there are a lot that will have 2 or 3 that will get 3.5 stars.
But more dining deals now, especially with the economy. They're really out there, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, as I was putting together the list, the thing that struck me was I was lowering the prices of the restaurants that reappeared. And I think just about every restaurant, if they haven't gone down, they've stayed about the same. And just about everyone's offering dining deals. I know, Marcia, you do some of
that.
Yeah,
well, Marcia, you've got some deals. Talk about it.
Well, I've been inundated with news about restaurant deals for the past, I'd say, 4 months, 5 months. I mean, you're seeing even some of the really high-end restaurants, let's say Masa's, you know, they're offering some deals for early diners, pre-theater dining. Michael Mina, what else?
There was $55 another. For
yeah.
his.
Yeah. So, you know, what's happening is people are – they want to dine out, but they're going for more, as my friend says, affordable luxury. And, you know, I think some of the best deals can be found on Monday nights. Even Jardiniere is doing like a Monday night 3-course meal for $45. So you're able to actually experience some higher end restaurants for, I'd say, a pretty decent price. But then, you know, you can actually go to, you know, happy hours are really on the rise right now, and they're trying to give away free food during happy hour. So that's happening as well.
The whole industry seems to be changing with this economy in a number of ways. I mean, you know, in fact, there was an article just today by your colleague, Michael, Stacy Fitz, who was saying people are throwing fits in restaurants. I mean, restaurateurs are complaining about the behavior and the aggression and the entitlement of And then at the same time, one keeps reading about restaurants trying to drive their prices down. A column Michael wrote, in fact, and I'll bring all of you into this discussion because I think it's important, about people going into Rouge Cafe in Berkeley, which is a fine restaurant. I've eaten there a couple times myself, and demanding certain kinds of perks lest they write a bad review for Yelp, which I thought was horrifying. But, you know, this kind of strong-arm stuff, I mean, are we seeing changes in the industry along these lines?
I think around the edges. I don't think that most people do that. I do think that you have a few of those types who say, if you don't give me this, I'm going to write a bad review. But I don't think that's prevalent.
No, I agree. I think there are always a few bad apples. But overall, I think there's a strong sense of ethics around how we cover food in the Bay Area. A lot of passionate people with there are so many incredible blogs out there. And, you know, it's more about people talking about what they're passionate about. You go to Yelp, definitely there are some negative reviews. Sometimes, you know, it's easier for people to complain than to write nice things in that particular forum.
But that's true in Zagat, too, isn't it?
I think that we get the strongest comments on both ends of the spectrum. We get the adorations and we get the people who have had really horrible experiences. And those are the most passionately commented restaurants we get, and there's a lot less of the middle experience. But the great thing
like the way people respond to radio, actually.
Yeah, there you go. But, you know, I think my job and the job of the full-time staff at Zagat is to really filter and synthesize the comments so that we are not getting, you know, these rants unfiltered. And there's a place for rants, and if there is a general trend towards a negative comment about a restaurant, it will certainly make its way into the review. But there's a way to kind of soften around the edges. And so you don't have people's mothers who are dominating the reviews, and you don't have disgruntled diners as well.
Well, I was reading an article of yours, Michael Bauer, where you were talking about sort of taking people through the steps of assessing a restaurant, from how you're treated when you mm-hmm. make the reservation to how you're met at the door, the service menu, wine list, and so forth. It still boils down for most people, I imagine, and maybe I don't know if we can get consensus on this or not, but the food. I mean, ambience and all those things, service are important, but isn't with most people food?
I think in the Bay Area that's mostly true, although, you know, with email we all get so many get so much correspondence these days, and repeatedly I get something that will talk about how terrible the food is. And if you actually read the email, what they're talking about is they felt dissed in a restaurant, or it was really something about the service that affected the food. So I still think that you can't discount service. I think that probably even in the Bay Area, people want to feel special. And if a restaurant can make them feel special, they'll put up with less than distinguished food.
Let's talk about distinguished food again that can be bought at reasonable rates. In fact, Marcia, you're talking about a couple of tips in reading your e-blog. It's not a blog. It's an e-letter. I'm sorry. Sin Tin Thai, Marty's Deli in the Tenderloin, names that I wasn't familiar with, and a place called SNT Hong Kong
Hong
Seafood.
Hong Kong Seafood, yeah.
These are not places that appear on the top 100 with Michael
Bowen. No, and I mean, that's the thing that I can imagine is challenging for Michael in putting together the top 100, is there are so many restaurants within the San Francisco dining landscape that it's the food I crave. I mean, I crave ethnic food a lot. I crave Asian food a lot, Japanese, Chinese, everything. And so those might not necessarily be, you know, the place where you're going to go celebrate your 40th wedding anniversary, but it's certainly something I want on a Tuesday night. So one place that I adore, as you mentioned, S&T Hong Kong Seafood. I have a cook friend. I love dining out with him. I'm dining out with Eddie Lau. And he brought me there with my sister. And, you know, dim sum is sadly become this, you know, rarefied thing. I mean, I love Tong Kiang, you know, Yang Sing, it's great, but I don't want to spend
$65. Michael always mentions Koi Palace too, by the way.
Yeah, it's another one, but it's just you empty your wallet. And S&T Hong Kong Seafood is out on Noriega and 34th. And I mean, I eat, and it was a $20 per person, you know, tab when all was said and done. Just really beautiful fresh shrimp and nice shumai, and it's great. I love, you know, those kinds of experiences. So, yeah, another one that you had on your list there, Sai Jai Thai, is one in the Tenderloin. And it's one of the more authentic Thai places that I find. But it's a little grungy. I mean, you go in there and I don't know. Sometimes I – well, I have actually looked at the kitchen on that one. But again, $25, you can go out with 3-4 friends. And I find, you know, sometimes you can bring in some wine. If you're polite, maybe offer them a taste. And you end up having a really nice experience. Bring in a good Riesling and you're done. So,
what do we learn, Misha Hom, about bargains from Zagat?
Well, we did actually just come out with a pocket guide to San Francisco dining deals in response to the recession. And what it is a compilation of some of the both bang for our buck restaurants. We have a kind of a formula that is the rating that the food has in proportion to its price. So the top of the list is Saigon Sandwiches, which is a banh mi restaurant, deli, really, down in the Tenderloin, and it gets a 24 out of 30 for food, and it's $6. And that's a really good value. But we also have restaurants like Firefly and all the other higher-end restaurants that do pre-fees and all sorts of dining deals, as well as strategies for how you could go out to a restaurant and save on your bill. But I think that's the bang for the buck, and Best Buys, which is two top lists that we always include in the book. That really helps guide people to restaurants that are in their price range. And I think that's one of the things that the Zagat Guide does really well, is that it breaks down food and service and decor and price. So if you're looking just really in your price range, then you can filter away all the other restaurants and just narrow it down that way. And there's quite a lot of great values in the book.
I had the founders on here a number of years ago. Boy, that's a success story. I mean, the whole Zagat enterprise is really amazing. And you're able to cover territory. I mean, to some extent, I think Michael and Marcia, you both might concede that the restaurant scene is a lot better in the East Bay and San Francisco and easier to cover than it is, say, down the peninsula or in the North Bay. And yet, Zagat does cover the territory.
Yeah, I say Mendocino to Monterey is my beat. It's a big beat.
That's a big beat.
That's a big beat, right.
A lot of driving.
And, you know, I was reading Marcia's e-column, and she went out and actually went to, I guess, 15 burger places to find, you know, there's a search. It's like the grail, you know, for the best burger or like the best corned beef sandwich or
the best cloth napkin burger. Yeah.
Is there a best fried chicken? I don't know. One can't really find it.
I've been on that.
Yeah. I'm sure Michael has a few thoughts on the fried chicken.
Or best pizza. But what about things like that? People really respond to that, don't they? I mean, just that question of really, is it a good burger, let's say?
Is it the best?
Yeah.
People
Pizza is, I did on my blog for about 10 months, I did Pizza Friday, where I did a review of a different pizza place every Friday. Because every time we would write about pizza, we'd probably get more response. And I think the number one topic on my blog was when I wrote about the best hamburger. Mm. And it's like everyone's talking about hamburgers, pizza. I don't think fried chicken is as popular, except maybe with me. But
me too. And, you know, you can't get good fried chicken.
Well, I think what I really noted when I did the book last year was the sort of gourmetization of fast food. So here in San Francisco, we want our organic food and we want our trans-free burgers. But we still want our burgers and we still want our high-end hot dogs and our sliders and our fried chicken. And so people haven't given up on the vices. They just want it.
I call it high-low dining, you know.
Well, actually, I think
Cali style.
I think as Michael Bauer pointed out, that organic and sustainable ingredients are so ubiquitous in restaurants now that you go in a place like Nopa and they're not even mentioned on the menu anymore.
Right. Yeah, and I think and that's kind of, I mean, I'm sure when you get down to the low end, you know, Chinese and Asian restaurants and things like that, they won't be organic. But when you're talking about anything that is more of a destination restaurant, it's just commonplace these days.
So Bix came out on top for you as far as burgers, right?
That burger's extraordinary. It's so funny. After I took two bites of it and I was sitting there and I was like, wow, there's something different about this burger. And sure enough, Bruce Hill has this device that he invented called the plancha press. And it's a weight that they put on the burger. And they time it. So it's about extreme consistency. And, you know, sometimes you'll taste a burger and it's made with really good product, but it's been overcooked, or maybe the fire's a little hot, but they've really mastered the consistency.
But is that the $28 burger? Is that just
No. Yeah, Friday lunch. Yeah, it was like $14.95.
Yeah, there's a big range of the
there's the deluxe burger with
foie gras. Or
yes.
Like
a little.
And I was thinking as I looked on that list, I thought, you know, some of the more famous burgers in the Bay Area are Bill's out on the avenues.
But not a cloth napkin.
And Phyllis's. Yeah. No, they're not cloth napkins. They're cheaper burgers, though. I mean, and they're not bad.
No.
In fact, Thomas Keller actually admitted on his program that he loves In-N-Out burgers, which is, I thought, rather brave of him in some ways to say publicly. So what did you come up with in pizza, Michael?
You know, I actually put a new one on the top 100, Gialina, which is in Glen Park.
Adore.
Yeah, I think they do a great job. You know, Arnell's is good. Gioia, I think, and Berkeley. So there are quite a few good ones out there. I think most of them are probably more Californianized, but, you know, A16 kind of goes up and down. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not.
Well, Table Hopper, I'm getting back to
Pizzola, yeah.
The fried chicken. Good frickin' chicken in Bernal Heights is on your list. Is that fried chicken?
No, it's
it's roasted. It's delicious.
Yeah, we got a fan here.
Yes.
Yeah, they have the Mokashan, which is kind of like this Middle Eastern burrito. It's really tasty. It's not quite Zanku chicken from L.A., which is one of my one of the things I miss about living down there. But
I actually looked at your list on Table Hopper, and I looked at Michael's 100, which and I thought, where do we come in common in terms of restaurants that both of you select? It's interesting. In the Richmond Aziza, these are just restaurants that both of you picked. In the Civic Center, Tenderloin area, Cortez. And in South of Market, we're talking about San Francisco now, obviously, Coco 500. And then in the Mission Portrera China Basin, you come in for more agreement than anywhere else. You got Dosa and Foreign Cinema and Range, the front porch. And then there's Bix downtown and Kokari. So it's a real range and a lot of agreement, but much more disagreement, actually, just for the record here. I mean, you've got
disagreement in what I'm...
Yeah.
Which list?
You mean between the top 100
yeah.
just what I cover
and
on Table Hopper?
Cover,
or,
yeah.
Well, I think one difference is, I mean, I wouldn't say it's disagreement, but it's just my philosophy on Table Hopper is I only cover places I like. And my criteria is, could I recommend a friend to this restaurant? And if I could, then I write about it. So instead, what Michael has to do is more of the critic's role and writing of the places that he, you know, deems fantastic or those that maybe don't rate so high. And so with the top 100, it's, you know, his chance to express the places that he likes.
Is all that just you, Michael? Because you take under advisement, I know, what your readers have to say and what people who follow you regularly have to say.
Well, the top 100 does boil down to my list, but I do take recommendations from staff members. We do updates in the Chronicle, too. I do one a week. And so that often comes about because readers are saying, you know, this restaurant has gotten really good or, you know, it's not so good. And so that's what drives me to go back. So, you know, it's kind of a list that, to me, is always evolving and always moving.
You have to go into restaurants in wigs and sunglasses, things like Ruth Reichel? I mean, do you have to go in disguise?
No, I don't go in drag.
How about disguise?
I have before. I think it's kind of difficult, and I feel uncomfortable doing that. So I'm not sure what kind of dining experience I have because I'm wondering if, you know, if my fat suit is shifting in the wrong direction. But...
How about these notions about determining Misha Halm, you know, 4-star, 5-star, those kinds of things? I mean, you take a very different approach. So.
We do. I mean, for one, I think a key difference at Zagat is that that's the collective voice. I mean, that's the original populist site. That a lot of
the communal idea.
It is the it's the communal thought of a restaurant. It doesn't mean there's a universal view about a restaurant, but it's thousands of consumers commenting on a restaurant. And so I think in that sense, it's different than one person's opinion. Not that one person's opinion is not valid. As a movie critic or a book reviewer their opinion matters, and we turn to those people. But I think when you have the collective voice talking about a restaurant, it really shakes out what rises to the top and what sort of sinks to the bottom. But then again, we really allow the diner to bifurcate their experience so they can really talk about the food or the service or the decor. Now, I kind of disagree. I don't think it's just about the food. I think the bar, the level of quality and flavor in the Bay Area is so high and almost so universal that good food is kind of a non-starter for me. And when I want to go out, I'm often looking for other reasons and other components of a dining experience.
How many of them single out parking? I mean, particularly where it's difficult to park.
They will mention it. Certainly any place in Russian Hill, North Beach, Knob Hill, Zarzuela is a place that, like, if you don't live in that neighborhood, you're not going there because you're going to circle.
Or if there's no valet or they don't want to pay for a valet.
Yeah.
The Mission is like that. And I will get that comment. And really, I mean, that's a disservice to the restaurant. But it happens because by the time someone gets through the front door, but they've been looking for parking for 35 minutes, they're in a bad mood.
They need a drink.
Well,
so the restaurant has a ding on it that needs to be earned back before that diner can have a positive experience.
Yeah, Michael and if the city starts charging for parking on meters until 10 o'clock at night, that's really going to hurt restaurants too.
Well, you talk in one of your articles about Zuni Cafe and Hay Street Grill and Greens having three decades under their belt. Mm-hmm. What's the secret to success of places like that?
I think they're all different. I think all of them basically have consistency in the kitchen, consistency in ownership, and I think that's a lot of it. Zuni gets knocked a lot for the service and how if you aren't known, and I think in a way that's true, but consistently they've had really good food, and I think that carries them. And if you're known at Zuni, you know, you get treated very well.
Marcia, you had something?
Well, I was just thinking that Zuni, one thing that's compelling to me about that restaurant is that it's appropriate for so many different occasions. And so you can go there for brunch. You can, you know, go there when you want to catch up with a friend or you're having a date or a birthday. And I think it really contributes to the popularity of it because every time I go there, it feels like the appropriate place to be for whatever occasion.
And it's not a manufactured restaurant. I mean, it's like because of that strange building it's in, it's just kind of happened. And so it has a very unique feel.
Definitely.
And to me, a very San Francisco feel.
And it smells delicious.
We're coming up on a break here. But one other thing about the downturn, since this kind of connects some of the dots, what we're talking about, it's easier to get a reservation these days, I guess, isn't it?
I mean, I hope so. Oh, yeah. I'm going out tonight.
but you know, the interesting thing is that I've been talking to a lot of restaurateurs, and what they're saying are their numbers are holding pretty steady, which is actually a good thing. But what's happening is the check average has gone down. So if, in fact, the numbers hold, that's really speaks well because what's going to happen when the economy starts turning, I think people will start spending more.
Okay, we're talking about restaurants, dining out, the changing nature of the restaurant business, and also about reviewing restaurants because that's kind of implicit in this discussion as a motif as well. You know, how impartial can the reviewer be, especially when you get fawned over and loved and all of that? Well, let me open up the phone lines and get your thoughts about restaurants. Or if you want a recommendation, you certainly have three good sources here to come to. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. And we welcome your phone calls, whether you're listening on if you're listening on Sirius XM satellite, it might be a little stretch unless you're coming to San Francisco Bay Area to visit. But if you're listening by internet or by radio, feel free to join us toll-free. Again, it's 866-733-6786 or send an email to forum@kqed.org as we continue with Misha Halm of Zagap, Marcia Gagliardi, of Table Hopper, and Michael Bauer of The Chronicle. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum, and it's an hour all about restaurants. The San Francisco Chronicle just released its annual list of the Bay Area's top 100 restaurants. We're talking about that new list with restaurant critic Michael Bauer, who is the author of it. We're also talking with food writer Marcia Gagliardi, and Zagat editor Misha Halm, discussing really the relevancy of restaurant criticism in an era of blogs and Yelp. And what about that? let's, before we go to our callers, the relevance, Misha?
Well, I think, again, I think Zagat has a great proposition because it has the collective voice that I think a lot of the blogs have sort of copied and adopted. But there is some rigor and discipline and vetting that goes in the system. And I think people are always – I think it's not just to criticize a restaurant or to deem it a certain star. I think the job of a restaurant critic is to discover great dining – great dining opportunities.
But these are lay critics, pretty. I mean, as opposed to, I mean, everybody can be a
Everyone
critic.
Everyone is a lay critic, but not necessarily. And people who, I think the theory behind the Zagat is people who are dining out 2, 3, 5 times a week have a certain a level of understanding of what they want in a restaurant. And I think that's valid too.
Well, how do things like Zagat and the blogs and e-columns and everything affect you, Michael?
You know, it's obviously there's a lot of outlets for and a lot of voices out there. So, and I, frankly, I think there's a place for all of them. You know, I think I probably offer something different than the Yelp. You know what you're going to get, whether you agree or disagree. So I'm kind of that singular voice. I'm probably out more than just about anyone because I'm out every night. And then, of course, then you've
with
got
no
Zagat.
Girth on you, which is an amazing thing.
You know, and then you've got the Yelp. The way I always like to say is that ideally, what I would like people is to return to me first and then go to a Yelp or something like that to see whether my review is still valid and see what people are saying in the last couple days, because on Yelp, every day you get new reviews.
So who has been most passionately in disagreement with you about which restaurant? What comes to the top of your mind? I mean, somebody who...
You mean
not,
the
other than an owner
people,
of a restaurant? Or I'm talking about just a regular kind of clientele type who just... Absolutely.
Well,
in total disagreement with you.
I think probably the people on Chow Hound more than anything, because they think that the list is too expensive. And there's an idea, especially like when I did Nopalito, that if you're a moderate or expensive restaurant, then you aren't authentic. And so it's almost dissing those ethnic cuisines like Chinese and Mexican, saying that they have to be cheap to be real, which I don't agree with at all.
Marcia?
I'm with Michael. I mean, I think it's exciting to see the growth of some of these mid-level restaurants, let's say like Pot de Feu, Nopalito, who are using quality ingredients to make, you know, and you're following traditional recipes, but you really can taste the difference in, you know, when someone's using quality product. And so it doesn't always have to be a little hole in the wall. But back to the earlier point about just all the different kinds of media that we're consuming. You know, as San Franciscans, dining out is our entertainment. That's what we do. And we're very, very passionate diners. So we look to a lot of different sources to find information. And I think, you know, I'm very grateful for all the food blogs that are out there that I can follow. Yelp, I think, is actually an amazing source of information. Yes, there's a lot of negativity. But then again, if there's a regular who's been going to a restaurant and they list their favorite dishes, that's helpful to me. And, you know, to Misha's point, it's like, as a food writer, you have to be curious about everything. And so, you know, like Michael, I'm out 6 nights a week. The one night I'm in is Monday night when I'm writing my column. And, you know, some nights I'll try something in one place, something in another. And it's all about really hunting things down. I think Yelp is useful for that.
Well, you know, Yelp, somebody from Yelp contacted me. They wanted to do one of these, you know, what's your favorite restaurant and what's your favorite wine and all that sort of thing. And I thought, this is going to be a real labor for me. And this is really going to put me out there. And wait, I mean, you put yourself out there when you take these positions and when you take strong opinions and, you know, sometimes really get people upset with you. I mean, that's been your experience, I imagine, through the years, Michael, has it not?
Oh, yeah, especially since I started the blog and especially with the Internet.
Yeah,
I always say that the longer I do the job, I don't make more friends. I just make more enemies.
Well, here I want to go to emails, but first let's go to our callers. And Gina wants to bring up something that we haven't even brought up, and that's the noise level in restaurants. Go ahead, Gina.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you for listening to me, because this is probably the biggest reason why I don't go to restaurants as much as I used to when I was younger, and that is just the noise overload. I mean, dining, especially if it's more than like a $5 burrito, it's a sensual experience, and if your auditory senses are just totally overwhelmed and you have your ears buzzing when you're walking out and your throat sore because you've had to shout at your dining companion, it to me, it ruins the whole experience. And I'm really appalled at how many restaurants seem to be constructed to amplify sound instead of sort of baffle it. I love the old restaurants with the big banquettes where it really does serve to partition off diners from one another. And I understand you can't have probably a restaurant just full of quiet little nooks, but it's just appalling to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, at the Chronicle about 12 years ago, we started doing noise ratings because people were so frustrated. And some people think that I should knock the ratings down because the restaurant is noisy. I don't believe that because there's a whole group out there who love noisy restaurants. Otherwise, they'd all be very quiet, like Fleur-de-Lis. So I think that's a result of people wanting energy. I think it's a result of the architecture. We like this industrial design now. So I think there's a lot of factors that go into the noise.
One of them is a demographic factor. I went to a birthday party at Le Colonial for some people quite younger than me. It was a birthday party given for my daughter in a room there. And the noise was deafening. I mean, deafening beyond belief. I don't even know how they communicate in that generation because they go to places and there's all that noise. And you know, you like to sit down and talk and have conversation. Can't be done. It's impossible. So you drink and you dance. I guess that's what you do. Right?
Well, there are some restaurants that I will say that is the intention. They do not want you lingering. And they will even talk about buying chairs that are not as quite as comfortable. And I've talked to restaurateurs who complained that the chairs that they bought were so comfortable that they were not turning tables.
People are just parking.
there is a
they
feeling.
They put tax on the seats.
There is a little bit of an agenda sometimes by the restaurateurs.
Misha Hamm, again, is the local editor of Zagat. And we'll go to more of your calls. Charlie joining us. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. I was eating Passover dinner yesterday, and we were all talking about how come there's no good Jewish food in San Francisco.
A common lament, yeah. An almost archetypical lament.
Because your mom was not here.
Well, no, you really can't get corned beef anywhere in the Bay Area comparable to what you get, say, in the East Coast or even in the Midwest, yeah. In places like Chicago or Cleveland. Although, I don't know, this place Sal's in Berkeley, as far as delis go. It's okay, but for this area. Max's is okay.
I think it's a demographic. Mm. I think it's the same reason why you can't get great Chinese food in Michigan.
You can't?
I haven't been able to.
No, I mean, I will do a little shout-out here for the Reuben at Morty's Delicatessen in the Tenderloin. They do a very tasty Reuben. But
there's a new Jewish delicatessen on Polk Street. I think it's called
East West.
Yeah, it's mediocre. Though.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I don't think a good sandwich is one that's just necessarily piled high with a pound of meat. I mean, that's really not what I look for in a sandwich, but, you know, for some people it makes them happy. But, you know, we're missing a lot of things in the city. We're missing really good Greek food. And
what about Kokkari?
Well, it's high-end, delicious Greek, but, you know, like a really good souvlaki, kind of lacking. So,
well, let me thank Charlie for the call. Sorry, maybe somebody else will call or email us and tell us about a place we're not bringing into focus here. Coley from the Tenderloin joining us. Morning.
Oh, my. I was wondering, actually, I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller. I love you, Michael Krasny. You're awesome. maybe your guest could speak to the topic of, let's say, like taco trucks or hot dog carts or like tamale lady with the street food. Here in San Francisco, it's really interesting how you have this kind of underground food scene. You have people doing Twitter accounts about I think there's like a new curry cart in
the magic curry cart.
yes. So it's pretty cool, and it's really like a new dining experience, even though it's not dining. I don't know. What are your opinions about that kind of underground food scene?
Well,
Marcia,
I just think it's incredibly exciting what's happening with a lot of chefs. Their perspective right now is to get the food to the people, and there are some restaurants. You know, I think we have sometimes, you know, too many chefs, not enough restaurants at the moment. Places are closing down. There's a lot of talent out there, and these are people who want to cook. So you've got, for example, there's a place I wrote up called Broken Record out in the Excelsior, and you have two wonderful chefs there who have a background, you know, spanning from Firefly, Boulevard, Range, and, you know, they're doing some gorgeous pulled pork. And again, like I was talking about, high-low food, quality product, but down home cooking great buffalo wings. And you think you look at the magic curry cart, like what you mentioned.
It strikes me if you can get the city permits, bricks and mortar is so expensive and renting is so expensive. Why don't we see more food out there? I mean, hot dog vendors all over New York. You got tapas in so many places now out there, and
street
sushi,
food on the rise.
Street food. Yeah.
Yep.
But then our beloved taco trucks are also under fire.
Right.
In the Mission, they're trying to shut down the
El Tonoyense,
for being too close to a school.
I love what they do.
But I think that is the golden ticket in the Bay Area. I mean, I think I personally will stop at one of those places if I'm driving through that neighborhood, whether I've eaten or not, because I can't resist trying the little delicacy that you can only find on the corner.
You cover that in the Zagat books?
We are limited on Zagat mostly to sit-down places, and sit-down is pretty loose. If there's a linoleum chair, I will call it a sit-down restaurant. But for a street restaurant, I will write about it on the Zagat.com blog that I contribute to, but it won't make it into the book.
Here's a listener named Graham who says, I love tasty, spicy Indian food, but haven't found anything exceptional. Any recommendations from any of you?
That could be a tough one. Yeah, Michael, go
ahead. Shalimar does some interesting thing on the lower range. I love Vic's Chat Corner in Berkeley. But as far as real spicy, nothing really comes to mind of that real fiery style.
And another listener says, guests have a favorite sushi place here in town?
Oh, yeah.
Figured.
Sabo in Hayes Valley is definitely, I think, one of the finest. It's within my own personal top 10 for sure. The seafood they have there is exquisite. And, I can't speak more highly of them.
What's top of your list, Michael Power, on sushi?
I still like Sushi Ran in Sausalito.
Yeah. I think Yoshi's at Sausalito is on your list, isn't it?
There's Yoshi's here, which is high end, but it's really good.
Sushi Run is owned by a guy named Yoshi, I think.
Right.
That's my confusion, yeah. Okay, here's George who says, we went to Beretta last Friday night, understanding there's a long wait and they don't take reservations. We finally gave up waiting and went elsewhere after an hour and a half when we realized that younger, beautiful types were being seated ahead of us. One look around the restaurant showed it was packed full of marina guys and dolls and zero middle-aged folks like us. We felt that restaurant was basically hoping we'd give up so as not to upset the buzz they were trying to achieve. Sound like a fair...
I don't know. I've taken toddlers to that restaurant earlier in the evening, and I think to some extent I can understand feeling the bias. I think if you want to go to a restaurant, you should be allowed in, and maybe there's a strategic time to go, but...
It's also the bar focus of Beretta as well. It's
like
bar first, food second.
I mean, that's it, because I love Beretta too, but it's inexpensive. It's pizza, artisan cocktails. And so by that very nature, you're going to have a younger crowd.
I want to read some more emails. Before I do that, though, I want to clear up an inaccurate statement that was made last week while I was on vacation. A guest came on and said that Pete's Coffee and Tea had been purchased by General Foods, and that is not correct. Pete's is publicly traded, not part of any other company. I wanted to make that clear. Some more emails. Laura says, when are restaurants going to get a clue and start changing reasonable prices for wine? I've seen wine selling in a wine shop for $15, for sale at a medium-priced restaurant for $40, and an expensive restaurant for $65. We now bring in our own, but we'd prefer to buy off the list in hopes that the selection would be somewhat parried to the food. It's funny, that column I mentioned before that was in today's Chronicle is someone who brought in Coca-Cola for their own corkage.
Right.
Good point, though, in that call. I mean, the wine is...
But I think someone needs to probably explain the expense of serving restaurant in a wine. And I think that's something that the consumer doesn't quite understand. There is the purchasing. There is the shipping.
The maintenance.
There's
of the
maintenance,
program,
the storage, the glassware.
The staff, the training.
The staff, the training. Yeah. I agree. It, especially as a savvy diner, you know exactly how much that costs. But it's not literally going to the fridge and pulling out the bottle of wine and putting it on your table. That is the expense.
I do agree. But however, there's no difference in markup at the ones that do everything you say and the ones that basically have a very small list and they pull it out from on top of the stove where it's too warm. And so you really aren't getting the service. So I understand that argument too. I mean, I think if you're getting the service, if you're getting well wine that is well selected and stored, then I do think that's worth something. My issue is where they basically don't do it and it becomes the profit center.
Well, here's a question tailor-made for you, Michael Barr, from Mark. He says, in the opening to the segment, Michael Krasny said, one item to be discussed was what to look for when you go out to eat. I'd like to hear a discussion of the premise of the question. Is there something that everyone should look for when they go out to eat? That was your whole column.
Wow. Yeah. No, I think there are like 76 questions that you ask from you know, how you're treated when you call up for reservation. Of course, a lot of people use OpenTable now, so that's kind of a different thing. But yeah, it's how the restaurant smells, how it looks, how you're treated, looking at other tables, what are they getting? So it really is being an aware diner, and it's also trying to separate your own personal feelings about how you're treated from the food and looking at things separately, which is what I try and do as a critic, and a regular diner doesn't necessarily have to do.
Speaking about critics, Kathy writes, I really like the newspaper-published restaurant reviews because it potentially comes from a consistent set of critics, and like movie critics, you get to know what they like and don't like. My concern is that they may be influenced by corporations and advertising. The less formal critical reviews come from passion and grassroots sources and as useful as just the regular guy's point of view. By the way, good and diverse restaurants in San Rafael, she adds. But all of those baleful influences are out there for critics, I suppose, like any kind of critics. I mean, I think about Roger Ebert and people like that, you know, getting the red carpet treatment in Hollywood. It can be very seductive.
I guess probably both the good and bad of doing restaurant reviews is restaurants don't usually advertise in newspapers. So I've never felt constrained by that.
Now so the problem is getting advertising, period.
Yeah, I mean, just anywhere. So,
yeah, same. I don't allow restaurant advertising on Table Hopper. So,
how about, listener writes, a Vietnamese restaurant in San Francisco, accessible by cab, cable car, or walking from Union Square? They're a party of four. They want something this Saturday.
Bodega Bistro on Larkin would be a fun one. Definitely. Because they have great family-style tables, and they do some really cool Hanoi street food there. And, you know, it's a great place. I always see nice groups of families, and that's I'm a fan of that one.
But as far as just
Michael
walking,
Barr.
Well, I mean—
A quick cab.
Yeah. You know, out the door,
mm-hmm.
which is walking, but it's, you know, in the basement of the San Francisco Center.
Yeah, I do a customized restaurant recommendation service on tablehopper.com where I answer I provide recommendations, but I always have like 7 questions that I ask people because a lot of things come into play with what's going to make a good restaurant experience. And one question I ask is, how old do you want your fellow diners to be? Because, you know, if I can't tell from an email, is someone 30? Are they 50? What are they looking for?
Do you ask about noise? How they tolerate noise?
I have a section for special needs. So do you want, you know, if you want to tell me if you want parking, do you have a vegetarian guest with you? So you want some more vegetarian selections? Are you looking, you know, are you cool with, you know, kind of a little hole in the wall and budget, of course. So I think, you know, with that, just with that question about a recommendation, a lot of things really go into making a good recommendation.
You're going to get flooded here.
I know.
Let me get more calls. In fact, we're flooded with calls. Alex joining us from Piedmont. Morning, Alex.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. My husband and I do not go out that often because we have small children. When we do go out, embarrassing to say, it's maybe once a year for an anniversary or birthday. We're looking for a really nice dining experience. However, it would have to be late because when we get the babysitter and then get over to the city because we live in the East Bay. So I'm looking for a recommendation for a wonderful dining experience, however, where we can be seated, say, 9:30, 10 o'clock.
Would it be a Friday night or?
We would do it on the weekend.
Uh-huh.
Madrid is great for that, by the way. Yeah.
No, I don't think that's a problem. No. They're going to be happy to take your reservation.
I'd go to Bix. That'd be a fun celebratory, get a little later night.
City
but again,
Hall
it depends what you're looking for. Like if you want a lot of activity, I mean, NOPA would be great.
Zuni Cafe would be great.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Bix is more of a sexy type restaurant. Also Gitan if you want something really sexy.
Okay, great.
Have
so
fun.
Much.
Thank you for the call. And on we go. Jordan, join us. Thanks for waiting. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I have a couple of recommendations for East Bay restaurants, actually. The last caller might want to take note. One is Fonda's on Solano in Albany, and they've got this great menu where they have $5, $6 dishes, kind of a bar snack menu that they serve after 9 o'clock.
Right, they do the reverse happy hour. They do two happy hours, an early one and a late one.
Yeah, and they're open, actually, till like 1 a.m.
Makes me think of Keats, happy, happy, happy. Yeah.
Exactly.
And so that's really
good. And
great.
It's on Michael's list, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
You're not ordering a $20 entree, but you might get three things for $5-6 a piece. The other place, actually, I think is owned by the same people, is Sea Salt on San Pablo. And that's a great place because I think after 3 p.m. they've got this really interesting kind of snack bar food menu of strange things like duck tongues and deviled eggs with smoked salmon. So you're saving money, but you're also kind of diversifying, you know, your taste. And you're not getting one entree. You're getting a bunch of small things. So those are two really good spots.
Well, thank you for those recommendations, Jordan. Kind of you. And here's a listener from San Jose who says, I eat out frequently and I'm looking for restaurants with more normal, that is smaller portions, and food prepared in a healthy manner, fewer calories, fruit and veggies, lean meats. I think I'm looking for a Chez Panisse that is closer to San Jose than Berkeley. Any suggestions?
Well, Manresa, but that's in the expensive area.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think that, you know, I eat out every night and I'm not overweight. And I think that people talk too much about the calories you eat at restaurants. I think that you can eat normally and actually very healthfully at restaurants, probably more so than at home. So to me, that's not a consideration.
I think you could try the Flea Street Cafe down in Menlo Park if he's calling from the South Bay. You know, there's a range of food. It can be heavy, it can be light. But
people could see Michael's face.
You can certainly find healthy food there.
Okay, we'll go to more calls. Patrick, morning.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is for Michael. Michael, frequently in your articles, you mentioned the service level in restaurants in the Bay Area and how poor it is. And typically when a restaurateur puts their staff through service training, it can be quite expensive. I wanted to know if you thought that would have a return on that investment if you experienced a restaurant that regularly had good service.
Yeah, I think you see that. I mean, you see that at places like Gary Danko. You can really tell if they have training or whether basically the waiters are kind of left on their own. So, and that's what I think most are, where you could have a really good experience or a bad experience, but it really depends on that individual rather than kind of the overriding policy of the restaurant.
Well, you think Gary Danko maybe 3 times, but always been superb in terms of service and food.
Right. No, I think they probably have one of the best, you know, service as far as the upper end. But, you know, the thing is, if the staff is really friendly and accommodating, then I think that supersedes whether they know which, you know, what side to put the plate down on and what side to pick it up on.
I agree. Like you go to La Chicha out in Noe Valley and it's, you know, husband and wife team. They're so warm and welcoming and, you know, it's just, it's comfortable. It doesn't, you know, is my knife exactly where it should be? Not necessarily. Do I notice? No, I'm having a good time.
And there are places like Delfina and Range and Maverick where it's not the sort of stiff button down service, but it's knowledgeable, it's friendly. They get to the food to the table when it's warm. They can make a really intelligent wine recommendation. So good service doesn't have to mean four forks.
No.
Well, you knew that there would be somebody emailing about Jewish food. Here is Seth, who says, Moishe's Pippick in Hayes Valley. Awesome. Best chopped liver around. Do we know that place?
We know it.
Yep.
I will make a plug.
I don't hear wild enthusiastic.
I will make a plug for the next several days. Per Bacco on Friday is doing a guest dinner with Joyce Goldstein, and they're doing Italian-inspired Jewish food, not a Seder, but Jewish food. Delfina has Jewish food on the menu this week.
With
and
the Stoll family matzo balls.
With the walnut in the matzo ball. And
Palio
is doing one. Firefly is doing one. You can have even vegetarian brisket if you should desire
it. I'll pass on that.
So there are places, there are stealth places out there to get some good Jewish tasties.
But do you know about Tunisian food? Here's a listener named Alan who says Cafe
Zaytouna. Yeah.
Best authentic Tunisian food in San Francisco, corner of Polk and Sutter. Check it out. My partner grew up in Tunisia and vouched for it.
It's a nice little spot.
Here's Liz who says, another distraction and enjoyment of your food is someone's perfume. Patrons should realize perfumes interfere with taste. Restaurant staff wearing perfumes that announced itself at a client's table or doing the restaurant a disservice. Mr. Bauer, Daniel writes, it's well known in the restaurant industry that Sunday is a poor day for service, the B team, if you will. How do you determine when is the best time to eat somewhere? Your recent review of Absinthe seemed designed to avoid the high quality of service I rely on there Wednesday through Saturday, the A-team for pre- and post-performance meals.
Well, I guess the glib answer would be that I'm charged the same if I go on Sunday than if I go on Saturday. And so it's the restaurant's job to have, good service all the time. But I don't necessarily think that's true. I think it depends on the restaurant. Some do have good service all the time. I don't necessarily think that I got B-team service at Absinthe, but perhaps I did.
Where have you particularly gotten – you mentioned Gary Danko. I mean, it's usually the top drawer or the high end that have the best service. But anything come to mind where maybe on that lower level, in terms of cost, you also get really good sterling service?
Well, I think Misha mentioned – when she mentioned Delfina, I mean, to me – when I went in there, it was surprising because a lot of the people had tattoos and they were from, the Mission neighborhood. And you would think that it would be really sloppy service, but it was very casual and very precise, and they've maintained that.
Yeah, no, I had the same experience there, and I like the people who run it and own it too.
Yeah, asking them about Italian wine, you'll get some really good answers. So,
well, I want to get some answers from you before we wrap up here. Very little time left. What kind of a short list, couple really good bargains, Misha?
A couple of good bargains. For what kind of dining?
Anywhere in the Bay Area, just right at the top of your head. This is free association. Think about it for a moment. We'll go to Marcy and we'll come back to you.
Well, I just was learning about Giovino on Union Street. They're doing these $9 dinners every night. So spaghetti and meatballs, more like kind of home cooking style. Can't beat that. But, again, I'm really a big fan of ethnic foods. So, like I said earlier, Sai Jai Thai or Broken Record. Or actually, you could even go to 15 Romolo and sit on the bar stool there, have a nice little meal.
And Michael Bauer.
Well, a place I go to a lot on weekends at lunch is El Metate, mm-hmm. which is at Bryant and 22nd. I mean, just kind of a very inexpensive Mexican restaurant. I also like, for very inexpensive Chinese food, a Gourmet Carousel, which is on Franklin. And they have some really good, wonton soup, huge portions. You always take some home. So those are two of mine.
Great. Misha?
Well, I would say Firefly if I want to have a sit-down restaurant experience, because they have just a dirt cheap three-course early bird. And
where is that?
That is on 24th Street and Diamond in Noe Valley. And Good Luck Dim Sum is not going to be a very plush experience,
but
you will get
good.
Dim sum for about a tenth of what you'll pay
in
another restaurant.
That's right on Clement Street.
Oh, and Turtle Tower, too. Can't beat that one on Larkin.
Thank you all for a splendid and informative hour. Michael Bauer of The Chronicle, Marcia Gaglieri of the TableHopper.com, and Misha Halm of Zagab. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.